our news. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Years ago, after Watergate and its unsavory revelations about money and politics, Americans were ready for campaign finance reform. In 1974, spending caps and contribution limits were set on federal races. But 2 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court's Buckley versus Vallejo ruling set aside the spending caps, saying they violated free speech, while the contribution limits remained. And so new ways to get around those restrictions were invented, from soft money given to parties to political action committees to super PACs. Then about a decade ago, the McCain-Feingold law limited soft money and some political advertising, but that law was largely undone within a few years by two Supreme Court cases, especially the Citizens United decision of 2010. And then last week, the High Court's McCutcheon ruling lifted another restriction on political spending, a limit on how many campaigns or causes one individual can give to. Now those involved in this issue are sorting through what it means for incumbents, for challengers, and for our political system. Today in The Exchange, the Supreme Court's McCutcheon decision and its impact on our elections. We begin with John Grabe for the legal side of this. And John Grabe is a professor of constitutional law at UNH Law, director of the Warren B. Rudman Center there. And John Grabe, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for inviting me, Laura.
Well, give us the who and what of this, John, if you could, please. Who was McCutcheon and what was the big legal question at stake here?
Well, McCutcheon was an Alabama businessman who took issue with a provision of federal campaign finance law that limited the total amount of money that he could contribute to candidates for office and to national and local political parties during any 2-year election cycle. The 2-year election cycle refers to the fact that every 2 years we hold federal elections for some Senate seats and for the House of Representatives. So under federal law, there was a cap that limited the total amount of money that you could give to candidates for office and to these various parties. And McCutcheon wanted to give more. And so he challenged that provision of federal law as a violation of his First Amendment rights political speech and political participation. And he prevailed in a close decision at the Supreme Court last week.
So he wanted to give as much as he wanted to give. Current law said you can't do that. And he said, hey, that's violating my First Amendment rights.
That's right.
You said it was a close decision, and you're right. Chief Justice Roberts wrote for the majority. What was his basic argument, John?
Well, he accepted the argument that that the First Amendment does protect with great vigor the right of individuals to make campaign contributions. And that was significant because the first time this issue went to the Supreme Court was in a landmark decision called Buckley versus Vallejo, which was decided by the Supreme Court in the 1970s. Buckley versus Vallejo was the first time the court took up the issue of federal campaign finance regulation in response to 1971 statutory changes that Congress enacted to attempt to limit the influence of money in politics. Buckley divided the world into two. Buckley said that the First Amendment does protect the right of a political campaign and one running for political office to spend as much money as he or she would like. And so Buckley said that any measure limiting the ability of a candidate for office to spend has to be looked at under the most exacting form of judicial scrutiny, which is basically code for saying that's going to be unconstitutional. At the same time, Buckley said that contributions to candidates could be regulated somewhat more broadly. And the reason for that was that contributions to candidates can give rise to an appearance of corruption, and that Congress had a strong enough interest in regulating corruption and the appearance of corruption to be able to limit the amount of contributions. And so the contribution limits and these aggregate limits that we've been talking about, these are rooted in this legislation that was upheld in this case in the 1970s. This case, the McCutcheon case, is significant because it calls into question that bifurcation. It leaves the contribution limits intact, but it suggests that maybe the First Amendment is going to have the same sort of bite with respect to contribution limits as it does with respect to expenditures.
Okay, I'm glad you cleared that up. So there's been this long bifurcation, as you put it, between whether we can limit what a candidate spends, and you're saying the court kind of got rid of that largely 40 years ago, but we've still had this debate over the past four decades over contributions, how much, who, and so forth. And so that's what was at issue with this McCutcheon case.
Well, yes, one part of it, okay, because there's two aspects in which contributions, oversimplifying a little bit, but contributions are limited directly in that the law says you can only give so much to each candidate who's running for office. McCutcheon left that part of the law intact. But the law also said there's also a limit to how much you can contribute overall to, you know, if you wanted to give to every candidate running for office during a two-year cycle. There's a ceiling, and it's that ceiling that was struck down on First Amendment ground.
Well, Justice Breyer wrote for the opposition, and from what I've read, John, it was pretty forceful. What did Justice Breyer have to say about this?
Well, the most interesting aspect of Justice Breyer's dissent to me was his suggestion that the First Amendment runs in more dimensions than the majority appreciates. The majority sees the First Amendment as simply protecting the rights of individuals to express their political preferences with their pocketbook. Justice Breyer says that the First Amendment has an additional dimension, that the First Amendment was designed structurally to protect the right of the people to ensure that government is responsive to their collective will. And that's the whole rationale behind permitting Congress to regulate in this area. And he accuses the majority of completely disregarding that structural First Amendment interest.
Well, we've got two guests for the hour, John, who will untangle that a little bit more in terms of how it will affect our politics, whether the collective will of the people or voice of the people is helped or hurt by this. But one more question for you, if I could, please.
Sure.
So the McCutcheon decision, as you said, struck down limits on how many candidates one person can give to. What limits remain in terms of campaign spending after Citizens United, after this McCutcheon decision? What's left?
Well, there are still contribution limits, so there's still a limit as to how much money you can give to any one candidate. There are still limits as to how much money you can give to a national political party committee, to a state or local political party committee. And there is still a ban on so-called soft money contributions. That was what McCain-Feingold was all about. So there are still limits on how much money you can give to political parties, with the understanding that the parties are going to funnel that to candidates. However, I would suggest that within the majority opinion, it was really a plurality opinion with Justice Thomas writing separately to say he'd do away with everything in this area. But I would suggest that within that plurality opinion, the seeds were sown for taking the law, taking the First Amendment rulings even further. I think that there is some question as to whether those contribution limits are going to stand over the next couple of years.
So we could see some more challenges soon on this.
Absolutely.
John Grabe, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Grabe, director of the Warren B. Rudman Center at UNH Law. He teaches constitutional law there. Again, today in the exchange, we're finding out more about this latest campaign finance decision, the McCutcheon decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. We're looking at what it means, how it might affect our elections. Let's hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can post a comment there if you'd like. Greg Moore is with us in studio, State Director of Americans for Prosperity, a political advocacy group that promotes limited government, lower taxes, more freedom. Greg Moore, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Also with us, Rob Werner, longtime advocate for campaign finance reform and former national field director for the group Americans for Campaign Finance Reform. And Rob, good to see you too. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much.
Well, I want to start with you, Greg Moore. Your reaction. How does AFP feel about this big McCutcheon decision?
Well, I think it's important to look under the broader historical context. The First Amendment, as far as free speech, historically has held that people have the right to spend money to promote their political views, and that is a constitutionally protected free speech right. And as the professor pointed out, that those rights were restricted by Congress in 1971. Ultimately the Buckley v. Valeo decision. And the Supreme Court said that within a certain framework, you could restrict those rights to free speech because for the purposes of trying to stop corruption. in a series of recent Supreme Court decisions, whether it's Davis, Citizens United, or now McCutcheon, we're seeing that the Supreme Court is saying, be very careful about restricting free speech rights. We view speech as an absolutely sacrosanct component of our democracy, and we're walking back away from those. And so what we're seeing is, and I think the professor clearly pointed out that even the individual restrictions are now potentially something that could be challenged in the near future, as the Supreme Court is clearly reviewing whether or not or how one is able to restrict free speech rights. And furthermore, I would point out that the McCain-Feingold law, which was passed in 2001, McCain-Feingold probably saved individual contribution limits, because remember, prior to that, the contribution limits were $1,000, and now they put it to $2,000 for the 2004 cycle and have now indexed those for inflation. I suspect that were it not for McCain-Feingold increasing those, it might have made it much more likely that might have fallen as well, and not just in the McCutcheon, but perhaps prior to that.
I definitely want to focus in with you guys in a few minutes on this corruption issue, because that's also at the heart of this. But real broadly first, Rob Werner, I'm guessing you are not happy with this McCutcheon decision.
Well, I'm not happy with it, but it's not unexpected, given the court's decisions from 2006 to now under the Roberts Court. It really is a continuation of a philosophy of deregulating money in politics. So it's not a surprise. I think this decision, the McCutcheon decision, while significant in terms of the changing donations, the level of donations, ability of individuals to give to many candidates, I don't think it is as significant as the Citizens United ruling. I think that is a more significant change, and I think a more corrosive change, because it has given rise to dark money, 501c4 groups primarily, that are able to spend in independent expenditures on races supporting or opposing candidates, and we don't know where that money is coming from. I think that's the larger problem.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break, and we'll hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR reaches listeners all over New Hampshire. If you own or operate a business, you can get your message to the entire state by simply becoming an NHPR underwriter. Visit the support page at nhpr.org to find out more about our many underwriting opportunities. More on the future of campaign finance on the exchange, then at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the politics of the West Virginia chemical leak and the mudslide in Washington State. New Hampshire weather flood watch through this evening in southern and central counties. Cloudy today, rain mainly in the morning, some scattered afternoon showers. Today's highs in the 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners. I'm from Dartmouth-Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health. 13 locations statewide. Information at d-hdocs.org. And Lewis Carno & Company, communications and public relations, proud partner of the SATA Airlines, with daily flights to the Azores this summer. Information at sata.pt. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the future of campaign finance after a major U.S. Supreme Court ruling, the McCutcheon decision, that removed the cap on how many candidates or causes one person can give to. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Now that you've heard a little bit about the decision, what do you think? Do you agree with the court majority that political money equals free speech? Should wealthy people and groups be limited as to how they spend their money? Is there so much money in the system at this point that it's all a wash? Give us a call. What do you think? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests for the hour, Greg Moore, State Director of Americans for Prosperity, and Rob Werner, former National Field Director for Americans for Campaign Finance Reform. Gentlemen, let's go to our callers, and Robert's waiting in Pittsfield. Hi, Robert. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm concerned about individuals who don't have money to contribute to candidates. And doesn't that create an imbalance? I don't have, like, if I didn't have money, to contribute, then I don't have speech. Is that not correct? Or, you know, shouldn't we bring somebody to the Supreme Court in that situation and try to show that speech isn't money? Speech is speech.
Well, Robert, this is the fundamental issue, so I'm glad you called. And I want to ask both of you, Greg, you first. This is the thing that we often hear from folks about. They're uncomfortable with the idea that if you have more money than me, you have louder political speech than me, and they feel that's unfair. What do you think?
I would say, just looking at the Constitution as a whole, it's important to understand that the Constitution is a limiting document. It is a document designed to limit government. So the Constitution is not designed to promote equality of speech. It's designed to limit government's ability to interfere with people's speech. So I think that's the first, and it's not necessarily a comfortable conversation or a thing to say, but that's really what the fundamental role of the Constitution is. And if you look back and reading whether it's the Federalist Papers or any of that, but I think that the point that historically has been made about free speech and the terms of money is that whether it was the Bill of Rights in 1789 when there were 3 million people, or whether it's now and we have over 300 million people in the United States, it's impossible for you to simply walk down the street and talk to enough people to fundamentally change the landscape. You need a way to amplify and promote your cause.
When you're
or your
a
belief.
Candidate.
Or not just a candidate, but someone who has a viewpoint. Anyone who has a viewpoint has the right to get that viewpoint out. But if you are limited simply to walking down the street and talking to people, that might have been fine if you lived in a village of 1,000 people. We don't live in a village of 1,000 people. You have to have the ability to get that message out. And the only way you can do that today for an individual, I suppose one could go around buying up every newspaper in the country or buying up TV stations. But that's not really a practical way of going about business. I think it makes a lot more sense to simply use the resources that are currently available. And the way to get that message out has historically been to spend some money to promote your political views, as sometimes as unpopular as they may be.
Understood. And Greg, Rob, I want to get you into this. But here's a question. So you're talking about limits on spending and that people who have a message, maybe a candidate, shouldn't be limited under the Constitution to speaking about their views, to spending. But what about the contribution limits? I think that's what our caller is asking about, that if you have more money than me, you can contribute more to Rob's campaign and you have more speech.
Well, I think it's important to point a couple things out. First of all, our electoral system, the way it's been structured, has created a two process system. One issue has to do with in terms of political communication. One process has to do with just as far as getting speech out has to do with a process that's regulated by the IRS, largely through C4s, C5s, and C6s, 501c4s, which are all three of these can advocate. C4, C5s, like Americans for Prosperity or the American Cancer Society.
These are the big groups that we hear
about. Large groups, C5s, which are labor unions, and C6, which are trade associations and chambers of commerce. Those folks are talk about what's called issue advocacy. So they talk about issues. And the other group, which we're talking about, is what's called electioneering, and they're regulated by the FEC. Those are the campaign committees, the state parties, the national parties, as well as what's known as the independent and expenditure-only parties, i.e. the super PACs. And those are regulated, and their express goal is to advocate for or against the election of candidates as opposed to issues. So that's how our system separates the two groups. And the contribution limits exist exclusively on the electioneering, i.e. the FEC-regulated candidates, PACs type operations. And those groups have had more scrutiny than the advocacy groups in as far as the issue advocacy. Now, what McCutcheon does is it focuses on that second group, the group that's regulated by the FEC. The net in terms of McCutcheon and what it means, first of all, I think that the people who are hurt the most by this are incumbents. Restrictions on campaign contributions benefit incumbents. They always have.
Because it's harder for challengers to get off the ground.
Incumbents know lots of people. If you have to raise $1 million through $2,000 contributions, it's somewhat akin to trying to fill a bathtub with a thimble. And who knows lots of little people who might write those checks? traditionally it's incumbents. So some people have called campaign finance restrictions incumbent protection acts.
Okay, and Rob, I want to get you in on this and then have another question for you, Greg.
Let's back up a little bit and get out of the weeds. The caller is correct. Those who contribute to campaigns are a very, very tiny slice of Americans. And these series of decisions have empowered them to give more and more money. And I think that the Roberts Court, Justice Roberts and the four who joined him, are not living in the real world because they have a very narrow definition of corruption. This decision seems to rely on a definition of corruption that you would that one saw in the movie American Hustle, quid pro quo. That's the only thing that seems to fit this definition of corruption in this case.
Quid pro quo means I give that. You X we, dollars
exactly.
and you go vote the way I want
exactly.
you to vote.
And we have a system that's corrupt. And this decision and decisions before them have missed this point. We have a Congress that's really dependent upon the funders, not the voters. And these decisions narrow that ever more and make that situation worse. So, yes, I agree that we are in a situation where those who have means are really more in control of who runs for office, who wins, and what they do when they get there.
I have another question for you, Rob. But just back to our caller's point, Greg, I'm still unclear on your thoughts, you know, 501 whatever aside. I'm still unclear as to how you feel about the caller's fundamental argument that if you have more money than me, your megaphone's louder.
In reality, again, the constitutional framework of protecting free speech is not designed to promote equality. It's designed to restrict government's ability to block your ability to get your message out. And for those individuals who do have more resources, or those folks who are committed to using more of their resources, because I know some people who write large checks who are not particularly wealthy, but they've made it a high priority for themselves to get particularly politically involved. So it has a lot to do with the propensity of individuals. But again, the focus of the First Amendment is designed to restrict government's ability to block you.
All right. Let me invite more of our listeners to join us. Robert, thank you for that call. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at the state of campaign finance after this big U.S. Supreme Court ruling last week, the McCutcheon decision, removing the caps on how many candidates or causes one person can give to, but keeping some dollar limits on those contributions. What do you think the impact will be on our political process? 1-800-892-6477. So Greg started talking about winners and losers from this decision, and Rob Warren, I'd like your thoughts too. Winners and losers from this McCutcheon decision.
Well, I think some of the losers actually are the lobbying firms and PR firms in D.C. and across the country, because one of the things that I heard is that there was a collective groan that went up after this decision, because those that are able to give $2,600 for a primary, $2,600 for a general, so the $5,200 limit to a candidate, now many people from many quarters are going to go back to these folks and saying, hey, last week, you were maxed out, but you are not maxed out now. So pony up.
More.
You have the ability to give. You need to give now, and you need to give a lot. So I think that it's not universally agreed in that community that this is a good thing from that standpoint. There are some also who say that this will strengthen the parties because you now have individuals being able to give much more resources to political parties. We'll see how that plays out.
Is that a good thing that people can give their money now directly to the party versus some
Well, they may have more
group?
Control over their money in this sense. You give money to a super PAC or to one of these dark money groups, the 501c4s that never have to disclose anything. And as we discussed possibly in 2012, was it all that effective? Was all this money effective? Was it targeted correctly in the view of those people that spent all that money? Perhaps not. Maybe now by giving to a party and saying to the party, I want this money targeted to a specific race, maybe people would feel a little more invested and feel that they have a little more control over it.
So you
see how
that
plays
out?
I think it's a good thing. We'll see how that plays out.
Parties could get more money.
That's possibly I think that could be a good thing. We'll just see how it plays out. There are a lot of unintended consequences that occur with these changes that we don't foresee.
Traditional old-fashioned parties, perhaps benefiting. Greg, what do you think?
I think that more and more we're seeing people break their affiliation with parties generally across the country. I think we've seen it traditionally here in New Hampshire, more so mostly because we have an open primary system. But also across the country, we see party affiliation numbers dropping across the board. And I think it's more or less because parties have a large array of issues. And most people don't follow those clear array of issues, and they're more granular than that. And so they don't buy into the full component of a party orthodoxy. And because of that, they tend to look more towards their own issues that are important to them, and their focus moves away from parties to groups that align with their issues that are important to them. And I do want to address one thing Rob addressed, spoke about when we were walking in. I was walking by the board here at NHPR, and listed on the donors is anonymous. So I want to know Rob's thoughts on the dark money that's come to fund NHPR.
Is anonymity such a bad thing in terms of donors?
I think there's an argument for anonymity, but I think there's also a countervailing argument that for the sake of democracy and people having information in order to make decisions, that folks can take a different view. I mean, Justice Scalia said during the time of Citizens United, when that decision was handed down, that people ought to have the courage to stand up for their beliefs. They shouldn't hide. And if people do not do that, he stated that democracy is doomed.
Do both of you feel that limits on contributions, lifting limits on spending, you know, all that aside, dollar amounts and so forth? What do you think, Greg Moore? Should we just have full open disclosure? Everybody who gives should have daylight shone upon them, and this is who I am. This is what I stand for.
I would say,
some people say that's the solution,
particularly in the nonprofit world. And one of the things that I've learned, not just from working currently in a nonprofit, but having worked with a lot of nonprofits, I worked for the Department of Health and Human Services, and I dealt with a number of nonprofits. One of the major issues that we came across was a lot of these nonprofits who engage in what they call development, which is fundraising, find that a lot of people simply don't want to have their information disclosed, as we see at the NHPR board showing anonymous. Part of that is because some people just want to do their work in private. Part of it is because a little bit of a donor fatigue issue. If people see who contributes, there's going to be 20 people lined up asking for a check as well. And then some of it happens from a situation similar to what we saw in California last week with Brandon Eich, over who was set to become the new head of Mozilla, where based upon a contribution he had made 6 years ago, he was subject to what the USA Today described as an internet lynch mob. And people have attacked him for a $1,000 contribution he made 6 years ago
to an anti-gay marriage group.
Exactly,
and Silicon Valley kind of came down on him.
The issue not necessarily withstanding. I mean, the bigger picture is a lot of people don't want to be subject to internet lynch mobs just because they want to make in his case a relatively small contribution for a guy who's worth a great deal of money, and the price he's paid for that has been enormous.
Rob, what do you think?
Well,
full disclosure.
I think full disclosure is where we need to be. In fact, it used to be the position of the Republican Party. They did not support public funding of elections, but they were all for full disclosure. And that has changed.
Now, is that a limit on free speech, though? Like, let's say I want to give to your campaign, but for various reasons, I don't want people to know. That's my privacy. Maybe if you make me disclose that contribution, that's a limit on my free speech. What do you think?
Well, we have limits on free speech. You can't yell fire in a theater, as a classic example. So that is a limit on free speech. So what's the countervailing, as I said, public interest? I think one of the problems we face with this dark money and the 501c4s is that these organizations give rise on both sides of the aisle to the worst kind of advertising, the most negative kind of advertising, give rise to personal attacks, And I think that has been very corrosive to our politics. And people, frankly, are much more willing to engage in untruth and personal attacks if they know that they will never be disclosed as to who they are. I would hope that if we had disclosure, that that kind of activity would be lessened.
Real quick, Greg, and then I want to go to another caller.
I just want to point out one of the, I guess, fundamental disagreements I have with Rob's position is that I don't believe that the First Amendment free speech is a negotiable public policy discussion. I think it's a hard line in the sand that develops a clear guidance for what we set forth as our democracy.
All right, let's take another call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Bill's waiting in Dover. Hi, Bill. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the exchange.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
In the time that I've waited to speak, I think the two gentlemen have already somewhat touched on what I was going to mention. I guess I assume and I accept that the court's two decisions on the amount of contributions, the amount of money that can be given, is free speech, and that it's going to be unlimited. And I think what I would like to know is who is trying to persuade me. That's disclosure, and I'm very much in favor of that. If I'm making a statement in public about a candidate or even myself, I would want to be identified.
So you're okay, Bill, with I don't want to say unlimited money, but a generous flow of money to whoever. But you do want to know who is behind the message, who's making the money flow.
Where is it coming from? And, you know, and who's behind it? That's what I would like to know. And then I think, you know, people I think are wise enough and smart enough to realize that, you know, money does talk. It does make a difference in terms of messaging when it comes to political campaigns. And, you know, we're talking about people who are running for public office.
Okay.
And so forth. And I think they should be the donors should be acknowledged. They should be known.
Okay, Bill, thank you very much. And we'll pick up on that point in just a moment. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments about the future of campaign finance after this big U.S. Supreme Court ruling last week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More conversation in just a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the West Virginia Chemical Leak and the Washington State mudslide, politics, regulations, and public safety. Then the life and legend of actor John Wayne, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Plymouth State University, offering new graduate education programs, including 18 MED, MAT, and Postmasters higher education options, now registering for summer term. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health, 13 locations statewide. Information at d-hdocs.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, an update on New Hampshire's housing infrastructure and how, given demographic shifts, it might not fit us very well in the future. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, new questions about campaign finance after a big U.S. Supreme Court decision, the McCutcheon ruling that came down last week. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Do you agree with the court's majority that political money equals free speech under the First Amendment should not be limited? Is there so much money in our political system these days that it's all become a wash? Should there be limits on how much people can give to certain candidates and causes, and how many candidates and causes. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Greg Moore, Rob Werner, before we go back to our listeners, we had someone calling in just before the break who talked about what we were talking about, Rob, and that's disclosure. He said, you know, fine, let people spend what they want, but let me know who's trying to influence me.
Right. So Justice Scalia, amongst the most conservative members of the Supreme Court, agrees with the previous caller. Let's just let all the horses run, but I need to know who's trying to influence my vote. I need that information to make an informed decision as a voter. And so that's a very basic point. In fact, within the Citizens United decision, which was a 5-4 decision, there was an 8-1 decision upholding the value and constitutionality of disclosure.
Wow, 8-1. We don't see that in the court very often these days.
So I think the court at that time in 2010 perhaps expected that we're going to open the system up, but we expect Congress to come into this situation and provide this transparency framework that did not happen. So now we find ourselves in the worst of all worlds, unregulated money that we don't know where it's coming from, and unlimited spending and unregulated money. And that's where we need to tackle right now.
Well, Greg, you touched on this earlier too, but your thoughts on our caller's point. I don't mind the money. Just tell me who's behind it.
I would say that as we mentioned, anonymity worked well for Thomas Paine and the writers of the Federalist Papers, and there was a pretty good reason for it. And that is because sometimes you want ideas to enter the public discussion without having the questions of everybody the motivations automatically questioned. And I think that again, what we saw in California with the Mozilla CEO is a perfect example of why people feel intimidated. And then, frankly, there is an effort put forth to intimidate people who contribute to political campaigns and efforts like this.
Here's an email that came in from Jack. He says, I don't have the kind of money to give to a political campaign as the big donors do. Neither do I have the kind of money the New York Times or the Washington Post has to publish its editorials favoring particular candidates. Should we limit them as well? Jack says, I wish champions of campaign finance reform would stop posing as defenders of democracy and be honest enough to say, quote, we don't like the freedom of speech and press as written in the First Amendment, and we'd like to amend it. This is directed to you, Rob Werner. Go ahead. Thanks, Jack, for the email.
So he's talking about amending the Constitution?
Amending the First Amendment. He's saying you should be upfront and say, look, I just don't like the way the First Amendment is working out in this modern society, we need to amend it.
Well, there's no need to amend the First Amendment, in my view. And campaign finance reform can exist with cherishing the First Amendment.
How do you do that, though? Because we keep getting back to this.
For 100 years, we've been in this model of regulating and restricting campaign finance. And as we see, it doesn't really work that well. What we advocate is a system of public funding of elections, small donor public funding of elections, matched with public funds. That is a voluntary system, and it must be so for constitutional reasons, as we've discussed. But that really is a more speech approach. That cherishes the First Amendment. That provides more voices into our political process. So there are many things that you can do, including transparency and disclosure, and small donor public funding of elections. You can do these things completely within the framework of the Constitution.
Public funding is how presidential elections, to some extent, used to be funded with that little checkoff box. But, Rob, didn't that system basically get chucked the last time around or the time before that?
People just said it's
not enough.
Right. But it needs to be reformed. There's not enough money in the system. It's a rational decision at this point for presidential candidates not to use the presidential public funding system because there's simply not enough money available to run a modern presidential campaign.
I'm just wondering how public funding would compete with these giant, deep-pocketed groups that we see active in today's campaigns. It just seems like a, you know, David versus Goliath situation.
Well, I would argue that you don't need the most money. You need enough money. There is plenty of campaigns, and I know that Greg can speak to this, where the big spender does not win. There's a point at which you have a diminishing return. You look at California with Meg Whitman running for governor, what she spent, what, $123 million of her own money, and she lost. What does that tell you? There's some point at which spending more money is not going to earn you a greater share of the vote. And Every election is replete with those examples. So I stand by the notion that candidates need enough money, and that is a very important aspect of how you construct and administer a public funding of election system. You have to give the candidates the ability and the resources to get their message out before the voters so the voters can make a choice.
But at some point, it's a wash. At
I
a certain
so.
Level.
At a certain level, it doesn't really buy you anything.
Because there's so much people tuning
out. Annoyance from voters.
You know, this is a really interesting point. And some people say, Greg Moore, that this was the lesson of 2012, that there was so much money and so much advertising, people did just tune it out. What do you think?
I would say that there's no question at which the message has to resonate. You can buy more TV ads, but if the message does not resonate, it won't make any difference. And you can make all the phone calls and send all the mails, the mail you want. There is a baseline you need to get your message out. If people don't hear your message, it doesn't do any good. Now,
so you're agreeing with Rob there.
I agree that more spending does not equate to necessary electoral success. I don't know that there's necessarily any sort of correlation there as long as you hit the minimum baseline level. We disagree on public funding, not because, as he said, it's voluntary as to whether or not you accept public funding, but it's not voluntary as to whether the taxpayers who are writing the checks to fund it don't get a choice. In the presidential election, they do, but most of the state-based public funding, they come out of the general treasury dollars. Now, if it's a purely voluntary system where it's paid in, like the presidential funding is, but as we saw, that has produced not enough money to put together a competitive presidential election as no presidential candidate.
That's because it hasn't kept pace with inflation, and that's why it needs reform.
But it was still a case of its being voluntary in terms of the people paying into the system. If you have a situation in which taxpayers are mandated, then you're going to have to, as a taxpayer, fund someone whose views might be anathema to you. And I think that's totally unacceptable from my perspective. I think that free speech is also the right not to say what you don't want to want said. So I would say more critical to the system as a whole. Is I think what we need to do is, if the fundamental reason for restricting contributions is to stop corruption, and if that's the motivation, and that's always been the motivation the Supreme Court has said for allowing any campaign finance restrictions.
Yeah, since Buckley versus Vallejo 40 years ago.
Instead
corruption.
Of setting up a cottage industry, which basically does campaign finance compliance, setting up bureaucracies within the federal and state governments to organize all this receipts and expenditures and all those things. Why don't we take those resources and put them into actually doing anti-corruption activities instead of saying that politicians are by their very nature venal and corruptible? Why don't we say, let's go find the corruption and prosecute the corruption harshly instead of saying, let's try to limit free speech on the front end.
I want to share another email with both of you. Jack, you thank you for that email. Here's one from Sarah in Portsmouth. She says, I strongly disagree with your guest. His political views see the Constitution as a document to limit government, which he continues to repeat. So that would be you, Greg. Sarah says, it does not protect my freedom of speech to allow the super rich to contribute unlimited funds to political campaigns. It simply narrows the field of voices to less than 1% of the population. This keeps getting back to that fundamental issue, Greg. People who aren't wealthy concerned that the wealthier have bigger voices under your interpretation of the First Amendment.
Well, first of all, I would say that there are wealthy on pretty much either side of every issue out there. There is no general rule of thumb. Every wealthy person tends to follow as a hegemony. Fundamentally, there are wealthy people who are willing to contribute on either side of every aisle, whether it's a case of small groups like labor unions getting together and pooling their resources and giving large contributions, and they're some of the largest contributions in the political arena, or other people participating with their own resources. So I would say that there are opportunities for people to have their voices heard. But I would fundamentally disagree with her perspective that the First Amendment guarantees equality of speech. It does not, and nor was it ever intended to.
Well, and that's an interesting point that you make, Greg. And I've heard others make that point, Rob, that maybe people shouldn't worry so much about this. You know, yes, there are donors who are wealthier than you and me, but they – come from all sides of the political spectrum. So maybe there is equal speech, so to speak, at least in terms of perspective. You've got liberal donors, you've got conservative donors, you've got everything in between.
Oh, certainly there are wealthy people all across the ideological spectrum. And our aim is not to get money out of politics. The political system needs money. Candidates need money. Political parties need money. People are free to express their ideas, and you need money to do that. I don't question that. Our perspective is that we're more concerned about where the money comes from and what that means in terms of undue influence of special interests and donors.
Be
and
they
large
on
donors.
Whatever.
It doesn't matter
end of
the ideology. App. You have Tom Steyer on the left-hand side of the spectrum who's going to be spending upwards of $150 million of his own money to advocate for climate change legislation. And you have Greg's employers, the Koch brothers, that are spending huge amounts of money on that side of the aisle. So everybody's free to spend that money, but we need to find an alternative to give voice and rise to the average person. We have lost that in these series of decisions from the Supreme Court.
Let's take one more call, if we could, gentlemen. And Victor's waiting in Milford. Hi, Victor. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I was intrigued by the comment that one of the people made that the purpose of the Constitution is really to prevent the intrusion of government. And it seems to follow from the discussion we've just had. My concern is we're treating the Constitution as if it's a holy book, in the sense that it was written by wise men, which it certainly was, and that what they thought and perceived 200 years ago is just as relevant today as it was then. And since they could never have, I imagine, foreseen a country of 300 million people and an internet, therefore, a lot of what's in the Constitution and the way it was framed may need to be rethought. And the question becomes, is that the purview of only the Supreme Court, only the Congress, only the executive function? I mean, how do we make changes in the perspective of the Constitution in this day and age without getting mired in discussions that go on for another 200 years?
Right. Well, it's a great civics question. Thank you, Victor, for the call. Real quick, gentlemen, Rob, you want to go first on that one?
Well, there's a lot of movement for constitutional amendment. And
that's tough to do, though.
It is very tough to do. However, keep in mind that a constitutional amendment has value, certainly, in terms of addressing campaign finance issues. But what that means, if one were passed to give Congress the ability to regulate political speech and money, then they actually would have to do so. So if there was a constitutional amendment that was passed, it would bring us back to the day before the Citizens United decision. That's not enough. That's not fundamental reform. Congress would then have to take actions like creating a public funding of election system or re-regulating contribution limits and things like that. They would have to take that step. Constitutional amendment does not provide that step, only provides the opportunity for that step.
Greg, do you have a quick thought there? And then I have one last question for both of you.
Absolutely. I think that as much as some people might dislike the way the campaign system is, the idea of limiting the right to free speech is a very dangerous road to begin to walk down. And I would do it tread very carefully. And I understand that some people might have some concerns, but there are more important fundamental issues to our democracy.
Well, and from this big picture question that Victor asks, and thank you, Victor, for that, back to the details of this McCutcheon decision last week. And Greg Moore, first of all, will this decision impact the 2014 elections, or will we see it more in 2016?
I would say that the landscape for the 2014 election is I won't say it's set in stone, but it's you're getting to a point where it's harder to do that. I think that people who are looking to raise money, i.e. candidates and the organizations that are built around them, have already sort of built a game plan. And it's kind of hard to change gears. I mean, there'll be some incremental change, but I think that it's going to take a few years for people for this to settle in.
Yeah, kind of with Citizens United in 2010, people say we really saw the impact of that in 2012, not so much in 2010, even though it came out early in that year.
I would disagree.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because within minutes of this decision being handed down, emails were flashing all over Washington in terms of going back to the donors that had maxed out. You got to get back to them. There was a memo that was produced by the law firm Covington & Burling that basically was trying to advise the folks that work with high-wealth individuals. This is what it means.
Another last question for you. Sorry to jump in on you, Rob, sure. But I did want to get your thoughts on this and Greg's as well. This is federal campaign finance. So here in New Hampshire, it presumably only affects candidates for the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. Is there an impact, Rob, on state campaign finance laws affecting campaigns for governor and state legislature?
Well, this specific decision is really aimed at federal limits. But also it does have an ability or provide an additional ability to give to parties, including state parties. So you could have some effect there. But I go back to the Citizens United decision as being more important and had the effect that it had in terms of independent expenditures during our governor's race in 2012, which was enormous, for example.
What do you think, Greg? Will this McCutcheon decision affect the state this time around, down the road?
We don't have aggregate contribution limits here in New Hampshire, so I suspect the only impact will be a little more resources to the state parties.
Okay. Well, interesting stuff. Both of you, thank you very much for coming in. Greg, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Greg Moore, State Director of Americans for Prosperity, a political group that promotes limited government and lower taxes. Rob Werner, thank you also for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Rob Werner, he's former National Field Director for Americans for Campaign Finance Reform, longtime advocate for campaign finance reform. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, housing mismatch misgivings. A new report finds that with shifting New Hampshire demographics, household incomes, and lifestyles, our housing stock soon won't fit us anymore. And it predicts this infrastructure mismatch could be a drag on future economic growth. We'll find out more and what its authors say might create a more balanced housing market. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where we get support from you, our listeners, and from New Hampshire Business Review's Financial Executive Awards, honoring New Hampshire's top financial officers and executives, May 6 in Manchester. Information at nhbr.com. And from Stay Work Play New Hampshire, working to keep 20 and 30-somethings in New Hampshire, working with and promoting the state's 11 young professional networks, stayworkplay.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. It's been 3 months since a chemical spill into the Elk River tainted the water supply in West Virginia. Health officials have deemed the water safe, but very few residents are drinking it. Last week, West Virginia's governor signed a bill designed to prevent future